We have four cases set for oral argument, three on our 9 o'clock docket and one on our 10:30 docket. It's my understanding that counsel are ready to proceed and have given the clerk the time that they wish to argue. So with that, the clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call De Leon v. Byrne, Mr. Michael Wallace to argue for appellant, and Mr. Scott Daly and Mr. Patrick to argue for appellate.
May it please the court, good morning. Of course, we would direct the court to the briefing and record on file for the substance of the points of appeal and the basis for those points of appeal. For purposes of oral argument, it would be our intent, time allowing, to address four primary issues today. First being with respect to Thomas S. Byrne, the right to control with respect to the basis of their liability as a general contractor. Of course, looking to the Lee Lewis case from the Amarillo Court of Appeals, the Amarillo Court duly noted that the interplay between retained control and scope of duty is much like a sliding scale, as more control is retained over how the subcontractor performs the details of its work, the parameters of the duty proportionally increase. And we believe that the facts which the Amarillo Court looked to in the Court of Appeals opinion with respect to the issue of retained control by contract as opposed to the exercise of control are very applicable to this case. When looking at the general contract between Kimco and Thomas S. Byrne in this case, the work is defined as basically everything by everybody that has to be done for the completion of the project. The general contractor, Thomas S. Byrne, is put in charge of the entirety of the work and is responsible for the entirety of the work under the Kimco contract. In fact, the breadth of this contract is exemplified by the language in the general contract, which provides that the employees and the subcontractors and the subcontractors' employees will be considered the employees of the general contractor. So it is apparent that Kimco and Thomas S. Byrne intended Thomas S. Byrne to be responsible for everything and everybody with respect to, as between them, with respect to this project. Safety responsibility was placed in the hands of the general contractor. They were required to comply with all statutes, rules, ordinances, regulations, whatnot. And then when Thomas S. Byrne entered into the subcontract with Mr. Purcelli, or Sparkling Clean as the case may be, it incorporated the provisions of the contract between the owner and the general contractor, attached various portions of documents incorporated by reference. The general contract provided that the contractor, the subcontractor, would be responsible for various things in addition to that. And so and one of those things is part of attachment B, as I recall, which had dealt with safety of the project. The very first sentence references the fact that Thomas S. Byrne has a safety program which the subcontractor, Purcelli or Sparkling Clean, would be required to follow, and then went from there forward to define what Purcelli or Sparkling Clean would be required to do with respect to their own safety program. And when one looks at the provisions of the safety program which Thomas S. Byrne promulgated, which starts at record 1688, it's clear that safety had virtually the same level of priority and importance for them that it did for the general contractor in the Lee Lewis case. When looking at the goals, it says the safety goals of this company are to achieve zero fatalities, zero permanent disabilities, and zero lost time accidents. Under the statement of policy, it says management and supervision are charged with the responsibility of preventing the occurrence of incidents or conditions that could lead to occupational injuries or illness. It goes on to say that it is management's responsibility to see that safety and health rules and programs relating to these procedures are employed to the best advantage. So clearly, Thomas S. Byrne is looking to its own people, to its own management, to supervise what they consider to be a very high priority issue for their construction projects, including this one. This is not just a policy which governs Thomas S. Byrne's direct employees, remembering, of course, under the general contract that all employees are considered to be the employees of the general contractor, but paragraph 1.4 provides a statement of policy for subcontracted work. It states in part that this construction safety and health program document presents the minimum requirements acceptable to TSB, Thomas S. Byrne, for construction conducted by its subcontractors. So what they're saying in the very introductory portion of this program is that this is a minimum standard of conduct that they are requiring. And throughout this 28-page program where they describe what safety is to be required, they do in great detail with very specific circumstances and very specific means of accomplishing those objectives. Examples. In terms of the scope, the purpose of the program is directed to the following: providing safe and healthy working conditions for all persons working on any TSB project, not working for Thomas S. Byrne, but anyone working on the project, and protecting the general public. It also provides under section 2.3 program effectiveness that it requires all equipment entering the projects to be inspected by Thomas S. Byrne personnel. Under procedures for administration, it provides that Thomas S. Byrne, as the prime contractor, is responsible for establishing, implementing, and administering a construction safety and health program, which includes auditing the safety performance and compliance of its work and that of its subcontractors with regard to a laundry list of things, including their own program. So they're responsible for setting it up, they set it up, they describe that they are responsible for enforcing it and provide the means for enforcing it, which includes ordering the contractor to fix any problems that are creating unsafe conditions, as well as taking over and fixing it and moving the subcontractor if necessary. And again, examples of the, in what the courts, if you broke it down into a broad concept, if a contract between a subcontractor and a general contractor essentially says, go out and comply with the laws, go out and comply with industry standards, go out and be safe. It's up to you how you do it, but go out and be safe. Then they're not interfering, they're not controlling the details of the safety of the work. When the contractor starts telling the subcontractor how to be safe, that's when we start looking to the sliding scale. How far does it go before too far takes you from a position of being a subcontractor with no duty with respect to the safety to a contractor with a duty for safety? And when we look at the various things in this safety manual, we see some of the very issues on page 1694. It talks about subcontractor employees used as flagmen shall be trained as to the method and manner of proper flagging, a very issue involved in this case. Subcontractor employees used to direct cranes, helicopters, backhoes, etc., shall be trained in the proper method of giving signals. One of the very issues involved in this case.
But didn't the contract between the subcontractor and the general contractor
See, the way we believe that the integration clause of the subcontract provides that the subcontract provisions apply unless they're in conflict with the other provisions. And that would just make perfect sense because authority flows from the owner through the general contractor to the subcontractors to the sub-subcontractors. And so you can't have what is an apparent integrated plan for the safety of a large construction project if a subcontractor is going to be allowed to deviate from the contractor's, the general contractor's plan for the overall safety of the project, which is mandated by the general contract. So we think that the argument which is raised by Thomas S. Byrne in that regard is actually on its head. And it certainly makes sense in terms of the interpretation based upon the circumstances because, again, authority flows from the owner down, not from the bottom to the top. And so that's the reason we believe that interpretation is incorrect as advanced by Thomas S. Byrne, Your Honor.
But that would probably be the case in most of these cases then, if your interpretation is correct. When you have a contract between a subcontractor and a general contractor that says the subcontractor is an independent contractor, and anything to the contrary is wrong, then I mean, by your interpretation, most of these cases, then the general contractor would be liable.
It would depend in part on whether on what the provision says. If this was just a situation where the subcontract standing alone says, obey the governing laws, rules, regulations, industry standards, then again, that wouldn't be an issue. What we have here is a comprehensive safety program which the general contractor has, by our interpretation, included through the subcontract documents. Now, which gets us over into the second portion, the issue of exercise of control. Thomas S. Byrne has contended that the safety program was not part of the contract documents. Well, if it's not part of the contract documents, then it is by definition an exercise of control, because the general contractor has affirmatively taken the position that as a subcontractor, you are obligated to comply with our safety program, and we have the right to create these controls. And these controls go beyond go out and be safe, go out and follow the rules and regulations. They say, you shall do these things under these circumstances. You shall not do these things under these circumstances. And that's controlling the details of the work. And that's the difference. It doesn't matter whether you call them an independent contractor or not. It's what you have the authority to do and what you, in fact, do. And so by having a policy which controls the objective as well as the methods and manners, in this case, safety, in this case, boom operations, in this case, flagmen, throughout the entire process, then they have exercised control by action or by conduct, even though it's not part of the contract documents, if you accept the argument which Thomas S. Byrne has brought forward. The second thing, which it looks like I'm going to run out of time here, and we'll talk about unique briefly on the contract documents, the position taken by Unique and the court with respect to whether or not the work was outside of the scope of the contract was based upon the April contract, which was the second contract. Yet in response to a corporate deposition notice asking specifically for what contracts were in effect on January 30, 2006, they attached the March agreement, and that was the deposition testimony from Mr. Bradford, their corporate representative, who they are bound. He was not there as an individual. He was there on behalf of the corporation. So on the very issue which the court entered summary judgment on, there was a fact issue as to which contract governed the relationship on January 30th, 2006. We asked for permission to obtain discovery once they at the last minute come up with this new contract. We were denied that opportunity. And Unique never made any explanation as to why they put forward this response, which says it's the March contract, but move for summary judgment saying it's the April contract, when the two contracts are materially different with respect to many provisions, that being one of them. So again, with respect to unique, as to the very issue which the court granted summary judgment on, i.e. the contractual provision that work being paid outside of the contract is not part of the contract and they're not responsible for it, which is basically the argument. Now, factually, there's no basis to support that because there's no proof that anyone was ever paid outside the contract. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wallach. Mr. Daly, I understand you're proceeding first.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Scott Daly. I've got the pleasure to represent Thomas S. Burns before the court today. Unfortunately, I believe the counsel's reliance on the Thomas S. Burns safety manual is misplaced. And that is because there is a contract governing the relationship between Thomas S. Burns and Sparkling Clean. And nowhere in that contract does it incorporate the Thomas S. Burns safety manual. On the first page, there's a list of exhibits A through I. The safety manual is not in that. There is paragraph 10.01K, which says that subcontractor has read and agrees to comply with the, quote, subcontractor safety responsibility and program on Thomas S. Burns Limited projects, as including Exhibit B, attached here too.
What page are you on?
This is on page 8 of the contract. I'm sorry I don't have a reference to the record, but I could get that to the court if the court would like that. It's page 8, page 7 of 8 of the subcontract agreement. It's on the left-hand column towards the bottom, subparagraph K.
Okay.
And then you turn over to Exhibit B, which is entitled Subcontractor Safety Responsibility and Program on Thomas S. Burns Limited Projects. And you go down, and the first sentence is referenced by Mr. Wallach. It reads, Thomas S. Burns Limited has a safety program which requires all subcontractors to have, should say their own, but it says this own safety program, and should be enforced at all time on our projects. So in other words, what it's saying is you have to have, subcontractor, your own safety program. Nowhere in this contract do we enforce the safety manual or incorporate the Thomas S. Burns safety manual as to apply to the subcontractors. Now, the safety manual itself may say that it applies to subcontractors, but if I were to go out and hire Exxon to dig a well for me, and I had a contract with them that was 10 pages long, that would be our agreement. Now, I can go and promulgate all sorts of things that are not incorporated into the Exxon contract, and that's well and good, but it's not binding on Exxon because that's not our agreement. So the safety manual, the Thomas S. Burns safety manual, is not binding on Sparkling Clean because that's not part of the contract. So their reliance that Thomas S. Burns said you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do this, is not binding on Sparkling Clean. Now, what Mr. Wallach's position that in the alternative, if the safety manual is not part of the subcontract, which it isn't, then that's exercise of actual control. That's not right either, because his whole complaint is, Thomas S. Burns, you had a safety manual that set forth 1, 2, 3, but you didn't make Sparkling Clean do that. And I think the key on actual control is Mr. De Leon's own testimony, which is part of the record, which says, would it be fair to say that the employees of Thomas S. Burns, the general contractor for the project, did not tell you how to do your job? No, nobody told me no. So Thomas S. Burns' employees did not tell you how to do your work, when to do your work, or what to do. No, nobody, not anybody. Did you see Thomas S. Burns, the general contractor's employees control the details of your co-workers' work, what to do, how to do it, when to do it, where to do it? No, I don't recall having seen them. So just to be clear, Thomas Burns and its employees do not control the manner, means, and details of your work. No objection. No, never. I never saw anybody there. Nobody came up to me. Now, you told me that the employees of the general contractor, Thomas Burns, did not tell you how to do your job. Yes. So they were not your supervisors, correct? That's correct. So Thomas S. Burns never supervised your work. No, never. Mr. Purcelli's testimony is exactly in line with this. He was Mr. DeLeon's employer. Mr. Gray, who was Mr. Purcelli, DBA, Sparkling Clean supervisor on site's testimony is exactly in line with this. And then the Thomas S. Burns personnel on the ground all testify they didn't control the manner, means, methods, and details of Mr. DeLeon's work. So there is no actual control.
In the contract, what I'm trying to figure out is the provisions of the contract that you promulgated indicated that you had this safety program, right?
What we say is you, Sparkling Clean, have to come up with a safety program.
Right. I'm talking about the contract between Kimco and you.
Okay.
You indicate you have a safety program, right?
Correct.
You indicate it's going to apply to the job at Montgomery Plaza, right?
Well, in certain respects. And those are addressed on, let me see. I believe that's addressed on page 21 of our brief, which basically, with regard to safety, the Kimco contract states that Burns will be responsible for the following: obtaining and maintaining and removing appropriate signage that has nothing to do with the injury-producing cause. Two, conducting its work, Thomas S. Burns' work, to create a minimum amount of inconvenience to traffic and pedestrians and provide flagmen for that purpose. That's not involved in the injury-producing event. Number three, complying with relevant safety laws and regulations. That's not involved in the injury-producing event. And four, performing work with a minimum of interference with the operations of the owners and its employees. I think counsel's reliance on the Kimco contract, paragraph 8.18, is misplaced. The title is Subcontractors in Coordination of Work, paragraph 8.1.8.1, which is right under that title, says, in all relations with respect to the work between the subcontractors and owner, the subcontractors and their employees shall be concerted as employees of contractor. Nothing contained in this contract shall create any contractual relations between a subcontractor and the owner. Contractors shall be responsible to owner for contractor subcontractors, and any fees and costs of subcontractors shall be paid by contractor. Basically, what this paragraph says, if you look back at the title, what it is saying is that as the owner, I am not going to interact with your subcontractors. I am going to interact with you, the general contractor, which is the way it works and should work in the real world. And so, if I've got a problem with one of your subcontractors, what they're doing, I'm not going to go to your subcontractor. I am going to go to you, the general contractor, to resolve that issue. This is a coordination. And as we all know, what does a general contractor really do on the project? Its main job is to coordinate all the subcontractors. They really do very little actual on-the-ground work.
Well, the general contractor doesn't do anything but coordinate, but they have this great safety program, but it doesn't apply to anybody on the work site, right?
It applies to our employees. We do have certain employees on the work site.
But it says it applies to subcontractors.
In the actual manual itself, but not in the contract, which is governing the relationship between the general contractor and the subcontractor.
Is that not attached to the contract?
It is not attached.
The owner and you?
It is. I cannot tell the court whether the safety manual is attached as an exhibit to the contract with the owner, but what I can tell you is that it is not part of the contract with the subcontractor. And if you look at the documents that were before the trial court as to the exhibits to the subcontract with Sparkling Clean, the safety manual is not in there, and the specific wording of the subcontract does not incorporate the safety manual. So there are very few areas where actually Thomas S. Byrne is in charge of safety. Now, if the court determines that the safety manual, which is not incorporated into the subcontract with Sparkling Clean, or that the Kimco contract requires Thomas S. Byrne to be in charge of safety, we need to look at the Menendez case. And what does the Menendez case says? And that says that if you promulgate safety rules, then you have to make sure that your safety rules do not increase the risk or the severity of injury. And that is not the allegation in this case, that the safety rules increase the risk, the probability of injury, or the severity of injury. The allegation in this case is you didn't follow through with your safety rules that you promulgated. That's two completely different things. And Menendez says, no, it's only if your safety rules increase the chances of harm or the severity of the harm. And so there's no allegation, there's no proof that these safety rules increase the percentage chance of harm or the severity of harm. So they haven't alleged a, quote, Menendez cause of action. There were...
I think we're almost
out of time. Okay. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. With regard to unique staffing, the plaintiff attorney, appellant's counsel brought up that the April contract was produced in a supplemental discovery response and represents to the court that the testimony of Mr. Bradford was that the March 03 contract was the contract in effect on the date of Mr. De Leon's accident. I would ask the court just to look at Mr. Bradford's actual deposition testimony, which is quoted with record cites on page 15 of the Appley Unique Staffing's brief. And I would submit to the court, the testimony of Mr. Bradford does not indicate that the March 03 contract was in fact the governing contract in January of 2006. Appellant's counsel brought this issue up to the trial court, and the trial court exercised its discretion, and it's indicated in the reporter's record of June 17th of 2010, where the district court indicated that he was not going to accept the argument that the fact that a party supplements discovery and produces a contract, that somehow either creates a fact question or that it requires some kind of a sanction that the second contract be ignored. It was also indicated that really the second contract was produced late in discovery and that the appellants really didn't have a chance to do discovery. The record before the court shows that Mr. De Leon's counsel took 6 employee depositions of my client after the second contract was produced. When we came up to the hearing, the court, although he denied the plaintiff's motion for continuance, he gave appellant's counsel the right to depose another individual if he wanted to and to supplement the summary judgment response after the hearing. They chose not to even take the deposition they asked the court. I know my time's running out, but I'll try to boil it down to one issue.
But I think the question is not whether depositions were taken after the second contract was produced, but whether depositions were taken after the plaintiffs were informed that there was at least, or at least understood that at least one person was saying that the second contract controlled. I mean, I think that's the time period we're looking at.
Correct, and that's, is that accurate? Correct. Those six depositions were after the second contract was produced, and they were on notice that this is, in fact, the second contract that's got the clause that says it supersedes the first contract. So they were on notice of it. When you look at the second contract, it's a simple rule of contract construction that makes it clear that unless a person is an employee hired by Unique Staffing and assigned to Sparkling Clean, they're not our employee. They're not covered by the contract. It's undisputed, Mr. De Leon, he was never hired by Unique Staffing, and he was never assigned to work at Sparkling Clean. With regard to Mr. Gray, it's undisputed. He was terminated in September of 2003 and not rehired by Unique Staffing until after Mr. De Leon's accident. Mr. Carter also not hired until after Mr. De Leon's accident. I would ask the court, Clerk's Record 1, Volume 1, page 0121 is the governing contract. If you just read the first two pages, there'll be no doubt in your mind that where Sparkling Clean hires this shadow crew, does not pay them through Unique Staffing, conceals them from Unique Staffing, they're not covered by the leasing agreement. Thank you, Your Honors.
With respect to the issue of the Unique contract, the deposition of Mr. Bradford as corporate representative taken as the first deposition in the case, Mr. Smith filed their response to the Deuces Tecum. The request number 6 asked for all documents reflecting the identity and terms of any contractual relationship between you, Sparkling Clean Pressure Wash, Priscelli, Gonzalez, etc., 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 and any other person or entity regarding pressure washing services performed at Montgomery Plaza on or about January 30, 2006, attached Exhibit B, which is the March contract. This response was never supplemented from a corporate response to say that any other contract governed. Under the rules of civil procedure, a corporate deposition is a deposition of the representative of the corporate defendant speaking on behalf of the corporation, setting forth their position, which we have a right to rely upon. Incidentally, when Mr. Bradford signed the affidavit, which somehow produced this new contract, he said he signed it, which he didn't. His signature is not on it. And so where that second contract comes from, how it got executed, when it got executed, what the circumstances are, we were never given the opportunity to address. The 6 employees who were deposed in between had nothing to do with that execution of that contract. So that is a straw argument. With respect to being undisputed about De Leon, Gray, Carter, and Priscelli not being hired by Unique until after the accident in question, the application is evidence that the application were filled out as part of a new corporation that Mr. Priscelli was forming called JASCO, and that's what those applications were for. One of the important distinctions with respect to the March contract versus the April contract, in addition to this beyond the scope for the shadow crew, which he has no proof of because there's no testimony by Mr. Priscelli or anyone else that they were ever paid in cash or directly by Mr. Priscelli. So that's a nice jury argument, which he's inferring, but he can't prove, with respect to how people become employees of Unique under the March contract. It covers employees who were employed by Unique at the time back in 2003 and all employees subsequently hired by Sparkling Clean, as well as those that are assigned by Unique. So there's 3 different ways to become an employee subject to this contract. The March contract doesn't have any paperwork that has to be done before they become an employee. The April contract does. So there are several material differences with respect to the terms of that. Now I would like to address briefly the Thomas S. Byrne argument with respect to the contract documents. Exhibit B was rewritten by counsel because Exhibit B to the subcontract agreement, first sentence, says Thomas S. Byrne Limited has a safety program which requires all subcontractors to have this own safety program and should be enforced at all times on our projects. He says there. The word there is not in this document. It says this, and we believe that this is the safety program which they clearly hold all subcontractors and their employees to be bound by. We believe that there are numerous fact issues which preclude the issuance of summary judgment, as well as the other matters set forth in our briefing, and we appreciate the opportunity to appear this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wallet. Counsel, thank you very much for appearing here today. Thank you for your arguments. They've been very helpful. It's kind of a, for a summary judgment, it's kind of